It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to a senior at Mosinee High School who's written a book about success. She talks to us about what she's learned and why we should craft our own definition of success. First, fears of a trade war between the United States and China escalated this week. After some initial back and forth between the countries, President Trump announced plans on Tuesday for sweeping tariffs on many Chinese goods. Over 1,300 products would be affected, including things like flat-screen televisions, medical devices, and batteries. Then on Wednesday, China hit back, announcing its own list of U.S. exports that it plans to hit with 25% tariffs, including soybeans, the top U.S. agricultural export to China. The tariffs are designed to target up to $50 billion of U.S. products annually. That matches the $50 billion of Chinese products that the American tariffs would affect. So what does all this mean for the economy and for consumers? Menzi Chin is a professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison. He also blogs about current economic issues at econbrowser.com. Menzi, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Well, where does this go? One side announces tariffs, the other side responds. Does this keep on escalating now?
Well, I think there's a great deal of uncertainty about that, partly because we're in very uncharted territory. I think upon the president's announcement of the what are called Section 301 tariffs, sort of tariffs related to accusations that the Chinese were engaged upon intellectual property violations, you know, the feeling was that they were going to be going forward, partly because of the rhetoric that had been surrounding the announcement of the measures. I think yesterday the president's incoming economic policy advisor, Larry Kudlow, he tried to talk down that sort of fear of a trade war. So here we are, the stock market has largely recovered, and we're unsure if this was just the opening salvo or really we are on the path towards implementing these tariffs. I mean, there's still quite a bit of time. There's a consultation period where comments can be put forward for the proposals, and then we'll actually see if these tariffs are actually implemented. I think Larry Kudlow sort of intimated that maybe we'll never see these tariffs implemented. That's the state of play at the moment.
Does the United States have a legitimate gripe about the way China does international trade?
Oh, absolutely. There are a great number of dimensions upon which we could fault the Chinese for their actions in international trade. These Section 301 measures have to do with the fact that China has not fulfilled its promises fully to crack down on, counterfeiting, trademark and patent infringement, copyright infringement, and so forth. And on top of just counterfeiting of goods. Although it must be said that they have made some progress in recent years in trying to address these issues. So there's this dimension. There's the dimension of, are they dumping goods into the American market? And those have been accusations have been pursued under different measures. So earlier on last year, we had anti-dumping tariffs applied to various items coming from China, like washing machines and solar panels. And then, of course, there were the steel and aluminum tariffs that were imposed on national security grounds. Those actually didn't hit the Chinese particularly hard, partly because they'd already experienced a lot of sanctions placed upon them on, once again, anti-dumping grounds. So there's a whole bunch of dimensions upon which you can fault the Chinese for their trade practices. The question, I think, is whether it's productive to go this route in terms of trying to move them forward towards more cooperative measures.
That's what I wanted to ask next. Is the idea of targeted but apparently widespread tariffs, is that a reasonable tool to use to get redress for our grievances with China?
I think that there could have been a different way of approaching this, taking these issues to the WTO, continued bilateral conversations about trying to push them to impose greater protections for our manufacturers and trading partners. But I think the sort of blunderbuss approach, it's not clear to me where this $50 billion worth of goods number came from. There's some obscure note that the number was arrived at an interagency discussion, but further than that, I'm not sure where $50 billion came from. And, you know, it was obvious that the Chinese would retaliate. And so the question is, was this a credible threat? You know, it was almost a no-brainer that if we were going to put tariffs on a large number of goods, that the Chinese would then, you know, target some obvious sectors like agriculture and aircraft.
Talking to Menzi Chin, economist at UW-Madison, looking at this back and forth of threatened tariffs between the United States and China. And Menzi, let's talk now about how this affects people here in the United States. And let's start with your everyday consumer. If these tariffs all get implemented as threatened by both sides, are we going to notice this when we're buying stuff?
Well, I don't think that in large part we will, because the administration made an effort to avoid putting tariffs on certain things that would have been very obvious, like, for instance, communications equipment coming from China. So, you know, obviously, like an iPhone that is finally assembled in China, even though it's got a lot of foreign components in it, if you put it on a 25% tariff, it would have raised the actual price substantially and noticeably to a lot of people. So to that extent, you probably won't see it directly. On the other hand, you know, whenever you put tariffs on things coming into the United States, it's going to feed through perhaps diffusely to various consumers, or it's going to feed into the production process. So the question is, you know, if pieces of equipment come into the U.S. to be assembled into other things that you're going to export, for instance, then this is going to hurt us. I think the more direct pain would come if the Chinese retaliate, you know, which presumably will occur if we go forward with our tariffs, and that will be concentrated pain. That will be concentrated pain up and down the Midwest, because if you think about it, you know, hogs were retaliated against in response to our steel and aluminum tariffs, and that was just a small amount, like it's like $1 billion worth of goods from us to China. But, you know, if you're talking about, for instance, soybeans, that's like close to $13 billion from a certain number of states in the Midwest. So it's very concentrated. And I think then you'll see in those states a significant amount of pain.
Yeah, I want to focus in on those soybeans. They're getting a lot of attention. I checked out the Wisconsin Soybean Marketing Board. They say there's about 11,000 soybean growers in the state. Quoting here, 65% of Wisconsin soybeans are exported, with much of that demand being driven by China. Ending the quote there. Is this something that is really going to be a hit on agricultural economies in states like Wisconsin?
Oh, absolutely. If the tariffs were to go into effect, it would be a tremendous hit. I mean, China and exports in general constitute a large portion of the market for soybeans, for corn. So you can imagine not just the impact for the farmers, but then all the suppliers to the farmers. And it comes at a particularly problematic time, to the extent that net farm income has been sort of stagnant for several years after declining from some highs about 4 to 5 years ago. So, you know, if these were buoyant times in the farm economy, you know, it'd be something that you might be able to sustain more readily. But now you've got the farmers having to decide what to plant at exactly a time when their fortunes are not particularly promising. It's particularly problematic, I think.
Could this be seen as a negotiating tactic, Menzi? President Trump saying to China, hey, we're willing to escalate here. We're both going to shoot ourselves in the foot for a while. Or you can come to the table and we can talk about these trade practices we don't like grown-ups, and fix them in a better way. This is maybe a threat to work out a better deal.
It could be perceived as just a negotiating tactic on the part of an administration. But, you know, negotiating and threatening, it requires that you be able to make credible threats. It can't be just empty bluster. So you have to weigh on both sides, both the U.S. and China, you know, whether each side is willing to go through with its threats. Now, for the administration, the fact that a lot of the impact in the agricultural sector is going to be in politically sensitive states, states that are critical for the Republican majority in the Congress, I mean, that must certainly weigh on the minds of the president, and it lessens the credibility of following through on the threat. And the Chinese exactly know this. I mean, this is not rocket science. I mean, people have been sort of negotiating, counter-negotiating, and threatening and counter-threatening for decades. using trade sanctions and threats of trade sanctions. So it was almost, once again, a no-brainer that the Chinese would target these particular sectors. So the question you have to ask is, are these threats that the administration are making, are they credible or not? If they're not credible, the Chinese will probably see through that, and it may not be the case that we get anything. On the other hand, you know, the president's made a virtue, I guess, or has attempted to make a virtue of seeming unpredictable, so there is certainly some uncertainty from the Chinese side.
A lot to watch out for. Menzi, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Menzi Chin, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about dueling tariff threats between the United States and China and what it could mean for consumers. Right now, we probably all want to be successful in life, but what does success really look like, and what does it take to get there? Those are some of the questions that inspired our next guest to write a book on the subject, despite her busy schedule as a high school senior. She sought out successful people in her community to find out what they thought about success and what they had in common. Christina Wenman is a senior at Mosinee High School and the author of Success Through Your Eyes, Learning from Your World to Find Your Way. Christina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
What led you to set out and discover the secrets to what success meant?
Yeah, so I've always been really interested in the topic of success and kind of I've been interested in seeing what other people consider to be successful. But it wasn't until about a year ago that I decided that I really wanted to learn more about how that or where that difference is between what I consider to be successful and what my peers consider to be successful compared to what older people consider to be successful. So about a year ago, I just decided that I wanted to interview older people and I guess write a book about it. So.
And how did you pick the people you interviewed? What sort of successes did you look at?
Well, initially, since I'm so passionate about business, I always looked up to people who were successful in business. But what I really learned is that people can be successful in whatever they do, and their idea of a successful life can either relate to that or be different from that. And so in the beginning, I decided to reach out to business professionals because I saw success through that. But towards the end, it kind of turned into me interviewing people like my teacher and different speakers and things like that.
And you saw some common themes come up as you talked to all these people about what success meant. Talk about some of the things that kept coming up for you.
Yeah, so it was really great because everyone who I interviewed had a totally unique perspective. But at the same time, once I went through all the interviews and went to see what everyone would say, I noticed three main things that were coming up, and that was the importance of authenticity, continuous learning, and success versus happiness. And the reason why, just to sort of explain that a little bit more, it's more of understanding that success and happiness become more intertwined with the more experience that you have and the older you get. And that's kind of what I learned through all of the interviews. So like I said, it was really nice because I was able to learn so many different things with all the unique personalities that I interviewed. But at the same time, I was able to sort of string those three things together and get a greater grasp of what success is.
You mentioned that authenticity was one thing that came up. What do you mean by that? How does that play out in our lives?
So authenticity as in like being just understanding who you are and how that will make you successful, because you can't be successful or what your type of success is if you don't know what you want. And I think I try to bring home the point that sometimes we get caught up in finding other people's definition of success, whether that be through money or impressing people. And we kind of focus less on what we want and what our definition of success is. So I really just encourage people to, and encourage the reader to find out what they want and in life as opposed to listening to everything else that the world has to say and all the noise.
And yeah, if I took one thing away from your book, it's that idea that we shouldn't be measuring success by comparing ourselves to others. I mean, it's in the title, Success Through Your Eyes. And you give some practical advice in the book on how to try to figure out what our individual definition of success is going to be. How do we get started?
Yeah, so I think, especially with authenticity, it just being self-aware and understanding what you consider to be successful. And in all honesty, you might not know that yet, but just getting started by doing different things, like just tuning out to tune in is actually one of the things that Jay Forty, who is a speaker who I interviewed in the book, he talks about just going away from the noise of the world and all the different little things that people are saying or pressuring you to think. Just tuning out to tune in. So that idea of once you tune out to the noise, then you can tune into yourself and sort of understand what you want, and then you can go on to be successful, whatever that is to you.
We're talking to Christina Wedman, senior at Mosinee High School and the author of the book Success Through Your Eyes, Learning from Your World to Find Your Way. She interviewed a bunch of people in the community and around the country that she considered to be successful in different ways to try to get ideas on what success is and how to seek it. And Christina, I'll say when I was in high school myself, I looked at the world of grown-ups and thought, oh, if there was somebody out there who was successful, they'd figured it out. They were done. They had it all set. And you discovered through doing this book that no, even grown-ups, even successful grown-ups, they're still a work in progress.
Yeah. So I actually didn't have that idea to make that into a chapter. So chapter 7, Everyone is Fallible, talks about how, and that's something that I learned through each of my interviews. I learned that, okay, sometimes when you're having an interview with someone that's supposed to be professional, they might spill oatmeal on themselves, or they might trip over their chair. And I'm not going to say who exactly that was, but I'm going to say that those types of things did happen in my interviews. And those were things that they didn't have to tell me. I was able to experience that just from having those interviews. It's not like I was interviewing them and they said, I don't have all the answers. Well, they did maybe mention it, but it was more of something that I learned after I did the interviews. And I kind of looked back and I said, I was so nervous to interview these people, but I kind of realized they're just people too. They're just young people who grew up. And that's a quote by Kyle Wilcomb, another person who I talked to during the process of writing the book.
And another theme you came across was lifelong learning. And that's something we love here at Public Radio. Talk about the importance of lifelong learning for our success.
Yeah, so I always knew that I've always been interested in being a lifelong learner. And it was really interesting to be able to hear that from the people who I interviewed as well, because especially being a high school student, when I think of learning, or when I thought of learning, I would always think of school and homework and tests and quizzes. And I used to have kind of a bad idea of what learning was because I always related it to school. And school obviously is a great place to learn because that's what it's meant for. But there's so much more out there. And once you get out of school, the learning doesn't stop. And I'm sure you all know that. But it's just really interesting to be able to understand that, okay, once I get out of school, I won't have to be learning the things that I don't like. Learning is actually really fun because it's learning things that you do enjoy, and that's kind of up to you.
You also talked to some of your classmates in the course of writing this book, and you found sometimes a disconnect between what they planned to do after high school and what they wanted to do. Could you talk about what you heard from your classmates?
Yeah, so one of the conversations that I had put in my book was a conversation when I was talking to my friend who, and I asked him, I said, well, where do you think you're going to go to school next year, or what do you think you're going to do? And I remember he said he wanted to go to Madison and either go into business or the medical field. And I was like, oh, interesting. Those are kind of different fields. Like, what made you decide that? And he said, well, I think they'll get me a good job and my life will be good then. And I said, okay, well, what would you do if you could do any job in the world and you made the same amount of money doing every job? And he said, I would be a history teacher. And I thought that was so interesting because it wouldn't be a hard path to take to be a history teacher, but he even said, I would feel so good knowing that I'm inspiring these kids just through something that I'm teaching that I love. And that was kind of heartbreaking for me just to hear that, because he wanted to go pursue this job that made a lot of money just because he knew he would be able to do it, whereas not everybody is able to go to Madison or get those jobs. And he kind of saw that through the money, which everyone's definition of success is different. So I'm not going to say whether monetary success should or should not be a part of your whole success definition, but I think it was really interesting to be able to hear that, and how sad it was to hear that he didn't do, or he wasn't planning on doing, what he would have had as his passion.
In the book, you also offer advice for other people in high school. Based on what you've heard from all the people you interviewed, what would you say to, you know, other people who will be graduating high school this year?
Oh, gosh. Just in one sentence?
Or five sentences.
Yeah, it's so tough because I even tell people I've learned so much more just through the process of writing this book. I just want to talk to people for days and on days just because of everything that I learned. And I think sometimes just telling them, like, sometimes try to do what I said before, like tuning out to tune in. Find your own definition of success and don't let anyone else's or society or anyone kind of pressure you into thinking that one way is better than another. I think just being true to yourself and understanding that that's the only way that you can find true success and be happy for your, like, with yourself.
And one kind of fundamental lesson, maybe something I get to do every day, you went out and talked to a bunch of people who knew things. And that's something that I wouldn't have thought of doing in high school, going out and interviewing people. Was there a value in just having those conversations?
Definitely. And it was really interesting because I knew at the start, I wanted to write this book about success. And at the same time, I was a 16-year-old when I started writing the book. So as a 16-year-old, I didn't have a lot of experience. And keep in mind not to say that I didn't gain experience, because experience comes with time, and same with wisdom. It comes with time. And so I didn't have that experience of being successful. And so I knew I couldn't just write a book about success, so I wanted to reach out to those individuals. And I, like I said, I definitely learned so much more through the experience than just what I wrote in the book. And I thought that was really interesting.
Christina, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That's Christina Wenman, senior at Mosinee High School and the author of Success Through Your Eyes, Learning from Your World to Find Your Way. Now here's a story about a big new factory that's about to open up. It's going to employ a lot of people and make a lot of stuff, and it brings up a lot of questions. How is this going to change the community it's built in? How will workers be paid and treated? How much should the government do to support the factory and to regulate it? How much pollution is the factory going to produce? This story takes place in Manchester, England, and Lowell, Massachusetts in the early 1800s, and Detroit with the rise of the auto industry, at a tractor factory in the Soviet Union, and today in China and Southeast Asia, and in about 2 months in Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin, with a scheduled groundbreaking for a Foxconn plant. In his new book, our guest tells us the story and history of the factory, especially the big factory, from the earliest origins to the modern day. Joshua B. Freeman is a distinguished professor of history at the City University of New York Graduate Center and the author of Behemoth, A History of the Factory and the Making of the Modern World. Joshua, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Well, I want to start in an afterword, a postscript to your book, Joshua. You follow the story from early textile mills to plants like Foxconn in China, and now it's coming full circle. Foxconn is opening a big plant here in Wisconsin. Is this a story that you're watching as maybe a next chapter in the story you tell?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's Foxconn that brought me to this book. I had never heard of Foxconn in 2010 when I came across stories about workers jumping off the roofs of their factories in China. And one of the things that struck me, besides the dramatic and kind of awful nature of that event, was the size of these factories. Some of them had 200,000, 300,000 workers. These were way beyond the scale of anything I'd ever heard of. So that's what got me into looking at the kind of prehistory of Foxconn. In a sense, this whole book is the prehistory of Foxconn. So, of course, I'm fascinated by the idea that they are now going to bring their model to the United States and specifically to Wisconsin.
And there are common themes going back from those earliest textile mills to companies like Foxconn, and one of those is a concern over the conditions facing the workers. Can you talk about, take us back to the early days in Massachusetts and Manchester, and talk about the lives that the earliest factory workers were living?
Well, yeah, the factory was a disruptive force, and one of its huge disruptions is it needed a much larger, more concentrated, different kind of workforce than had really ever been assembled before. And very often, they had a hard time getting people who would be willing to work in these factories. So often, there were very young people in England, often children and teenage girls. And they worked under extremely exploitative circumstances, very, very long hours, sometimes physical abuse, low pay, dangerous, smelly, difficult conditions, and also a whole revolution in the way people lived. You know, they had to show up at exactly the same time every day in the same place. They were under the supervision and every intimate detail of their waking hours. So this was very controversial. There was a great deal of criticism. So the miraculous productivity of the factories, this new thing, was from the very beginning accompanied by questions about labor exploitation and also environmental degradation.
And a theme that comes up again and again is how the government supports or regulates factories. And in the early days of the English free market, the government would enforce labor policies where if you quit, it was illegal. You were violating your contract.
Yeah, it's a funny term to use. I know what you mean by free market, but it was anything but. In fact, some of these kids were there because they were in orphanages, in poorhouses, and they were apprenticed by these poorhouses to these factories, which meant that they were legally obliged to serve out a term, 7-8 years. If they ran away, they could be arrested. The state, the government, has been involved in factory production from its very beginning until today. You can't really do this without a governmental infrastructure. It may be subsidies, or it may be laws, or it may be building roads, or maybe tariffs even. But there's no such thing as a factory divorced from the sets of rules and regulations and capacities of government.
And another theme, we see concern over the decline of manufacturing in the United States. We've seen this again and again. A place has dominated manufacturing in one sector or another, whether it's textiles or steel or automobiles or whatever. And then things change, and the center of manufacturing moves to a new place. It's almost like there's this life cycle of any given region's manufacturing industry.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the things that really came clear to me as I worked on the book, that this model of the large factory has been with us for 300 years. But factories, individual factories, don't last anywhere near that long. You know, and if they last, you know, a couple lifetimes, that's a very long time. The initial advantages of being at the forefront of technology, the biggest scale, and often taking advantage of workers who were previously outside the workforce eventually dissipates. You know, other companies start with better technology, workers demand higher wages, costs go up, and eventually the factory has to, you know, move on or even shut down. And so we see this kind of, as you say, life cycle. So what sustained the factory model is its reappearance over and over again in different places, not staying, you know, on a long-term basis in one place. So, you know, I would say, for example, that, you know, in planning the Foxconn plant in Wisconsin, everyone should recognize that this plant will close at some point. You know, it's not going to go on forever. You know, it may go on for 20 years or 40 years, and then there's going to be an aftermath. And often the aftermath of the large factory is not good.
Talking to Joshua Freeman, his new book is Behemoth, A History of the Factory and the Making of the Modern World. I just want to follow some of the interesting twists and turns for a couple of moments, Joshua. One is, you know, as we have the rise of automobile plants in the Detroit area and the huge River Rouge plant and others, some of the same architects and designers and organizers of those plants ended up working in the Soviet Union to build and design their mega factories. Can you talk about the weird overlap there?
Yeah, you know, it's not a well-known story, but when the Soviet Union in the late 1920s launched a crash industrialization drive, they recognized they didn't have the technical or intellectual capacity to build what they wanted, which is the most modern cutting-edge plants. So they turned to the West, especially the United States and Germany, to hire companies and skilled workers and architects and engineers. And companies like Ford went to the Soviet Union and helped build plants, in some cases that were basically replicas of their American operations. So the template of the large mass production factory came from the United States to the Soviet Union. It was a different social system, but the factory itself was not all that different in Soviet Russia than Detroit. And then from Soviet Union after World War II, it spread to Eastern Europe and eventually to China.
And there was this idea that you write about that capitalism, okay, communism, whatever. There's a logic, a hierarchy, an organization to the factory that becomes its own ideology, no matter where you put it in the world.
Yeah, you know, this was a much debated issue. You know, some people in the Soviet Union said, no, you know, we should come up with a socialist system of production that would, you know, give workers more power, be less exploitive. But they lost the debate for another group that said basically the factory is a tool and we can use it to advance a different kind of society, just like it's being used in the West. So as things played out, I think your description is a very accurate one.
And you also follow not just the economic side of things, but you look at how factories transform cultures and the reactions in the artistic world, the journalistic world, the world of fiction. Can you talk about some of the things you came across along the way?
Yeah, this is fascinating. You know, almost from the very beginning, people, particularly artists, recognize something new and exciting and different and dangerous was out there. So Daniel Defoe, you know, who we associate with Robinson Crusoe, he was like a factory tourist in the early 1700s. He goes, visits a silk factory, and he writes with kind of gee whiz wonder at the marvelousness of this. And we see the same thing through the years. Maybe the high point of this in the United States was in the 1930s and 1920s, when some of the best-known photographers and painters and filmmakers were just completely fascinated by Detroit. And especially the Ford River Rouge factory, which is the largest factory to this day that's ever been built in the United States. And painters like Charles Sheeler and photographers like Margaret Bourke White and filmmakers like Charlie Chaplin all saw the future. They saw modernity, for better and for worse, in the giant factory. And so they felt that if you want to understand what our society is, this is the place you go.
And I want to focus in on one of those Detroit examples, Diego Rivera and his famous four-wall mural at the Detroit Institute of Art now. And it loves the factory. It hates the factory. It's capitalistic. It's socialistic. There's so much going on. Can you just talk about that as an artifact of the factory?
Yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful assemblage. Detroit Art Institute grew up with Detroit, which grew up with the auto industry, and the head of the museum commissioned Diego Rivera, who's also already pretty well known, to do this mural. It was actually funded by Edsel Ford, the son of Henry Ford, who was on the board of the museum. And Rivera came, and he was sort of shown around the plants and around Detroit by both Henry and Edsel Ford, and he was completely intrigued by it. And he spent about a year painting this mural. He was accompanied by his wife, Frida Kahlo, and the finished product, I think, is exactly the way you describe it. It sees the factory in its sort of Promethean glory, man seizing, you know, the energy, fire from the gods and sort of creating this amazing machine, to which in some ways people are subsumed to it. I think, though, ultimately it's actually celebratory. It sees in it a kind of great triumph, even as it shows its downside as well. It like all great art, you know, it's not a simple portrayal, but it's still there. It's still wonderful. And I encourage everyone to go see it.
We're talking to Joshua Freeman right now with the City University of New York. He's the author of Behemoth, A History of the Factory and the Making of the Modern World. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions, what thoughts do you have about factories, how they've changed the world, how they've changed your local community for better, for worse, both depending on what time period we're talking about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the history of factories and how they transformed the world we know today. Joshua B. Freeman is with us from the City University of New York. He's the author of the new book, Behemoth, A History of the Factory and the Making of the Modern World. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts, and maybe your experiences if you have worked in your family or if you're in a factory or if your family members have worked there in years past, if factories have been part of the economy of your town or if their closure has affected it. Call in now at 800-642-1234. And are you hoping to work in the new Foxconn plant coming to southeastern Wisconsin? Love to hear from you. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Don't want to talk about factories and not bring up unions, Joshua. And you talk about these mega factories as being a breeding ground for union activity in a lot of ways and leading factories to or companies to move away maybe from these very biggest factories.
Well, yeah, I think that's very much true. You know, these factories in different places and different times have been arenas of struggle between workers and their owners and managers. And, you know, in the United States, mostly companies were successful in keeping unions out of the biggest and most advanced, you know, steel and auto and electrical equipment plants until the 1930s. And then you got under the New Deal a new drive of workers to organize in the face of harsh conditions. And at that point, what had been a great advantage to these companies, the integration of production in a series of mammoth facilities, highly efficient, turned into a great disadvantage because by controlling just a few factories, be it the Chevy plants in Flint or a key factory like the Ford River Rouge plant, workers could shut down an entire company. So they became kind of choke points. Now, this led to union triumph. And in my view, this led to the kind of golden age people are often nostalgic about, where you had the combination of highly efficient production and strong unionization, which meant that the gains of the system were quite widely shared. And you know, this is a period of rising income and security for American workers. You know, I think when Donald Trump says, you know, let's make America great again, at least subconsciously he's harking back to that moment in the 1950s and 60s when that unionization of the giant factory really paid off for working people. But over time, you know, a lot of companies really hate the possibility of this kind of choke point, and they begin to disperse their factories, at least in the United States. So today we have no factories on the scale that the River Rouge once was. It once had 100,000 workers. Today it has between 5,000 and 6,000 workers. And so we have many smaller factories dispersed to prevent just that kind of mobilization of worker power. Now, in other places where there was less of a threat from workers, be it in Germany where there's better labor relations or places like China where there's a more autocratic system, there you continue to see the giant factory model. But we don't have it in the U.S. anymore.
I want to bring in a caller now. Owen is with us in Wauwega. Owen, hi.
Hi. Yeah. I think this is a fascinating subject here, and I'm going to probably end up buying your book. But anyway, I found a lot of really neat ruins of factories in Lawrence, Massachusetts, Athol, Massachusetts. I know those areas. Holyoke, Massachusetts. The urban decay there is just so fascinating to me. Even Gary, Indiana, you know, just that wasn't very long ago. What's happened to Gary because of, you know, industrialization and the turn that industrialization has taken in our economy. And you can really see what it's done to a whole community, like in Gary.
Owen, thanks for the call. And Joshua, you mentioned earlier when the life cycle of the factory ends, it's not pretty. Whether we're talking Gary 30 years ago or Massachusetts, Lawrence and other cities, 150 years ago? I don't know.
Well, those Massachusetts centers were some of the most advanced plants in the entire world when they were built in the 1830s and 1840s. And by the early 20th century, the first of them were shutting down, and by the 1950s and 60s, the very last of them were shut down. It became an extraordinarily depressed area. Some of these buildings get repurposed, you know, they're artist studios or warehouses, but these communities have a hard time recovering because they grew up kind of organically around the factory and the whole structure of the place, you know, the social structure, the economic structure, the physical structure was built around these factories. And when you take them out, it's like you take the heart of the community away. I think one of the most difficult situation, say, is Flint, where you see the same sort of thing.
Thanks for that call, Owen. We're talking to Joshua Freeman. His new book is Behemoth, A History of the Factory and the Making of the Modern World. A big change we're seeing now, and again, this is not necessarily a new thing I find in your book, is mechanization, technology changing the nature of factory jobs. Can you talk about how that affects the life cycle of these big factories?
Well, it's certainly true that, you know, mechanization, automation is a very big issue. It's not a new thing. The factory itself, in a sense, was built on the idea of automated equipment or mechanized equipment. But it continues to unfold. In the United States, it causes much more job loss in factories than the factories moving to other countries. But what I think is not true is this idea that we are past the age of the factory. You know, robots are taking over everything. You know, in the United States, factory employment is only about 8% of the workforce. But globally, it's close to 30%. And we're pretty near an all-time global high in terms of manufacturing employment. So, you know, certainly we'll continue to see more introduction of machinery that will reduce the needs for human labor in certain kinds of jobs. But I think the age of the factory will be with us for quite some time yet.
And what are you watching for next? Your final chapter looks at, well, you go from China and then plants in Southeast Asia. Now we've got Chinese plants coming to the United States. What are you watching for in the future?
Well, you know, I think we're going to continue to see this pattern of migration of particularly very labor-intensive factories to cheaper areas. And sometimes this is almost like going back in time. You know, some of, for example, the garment factories that had moved to Bangladesh looked like sweatshops on the Lower East Side of New York 120 years ago. Other times, more sophisticated plants are moving. China is heavily involved in Africa now, and some Chinese firms are beginning to set up branch plants in Africa, much, much cheaper than in China, or move within China itself. So I think we're going to continue to see that. But, you know, patterns do change. Costs of things like transportation, communications change the equation, as do political interventions. And, you know, it's way too soon to know, but, you know, if we do see a increase in tariffs on a worldwide basis, that could change the pattern of plant location also.
And if you were asked to give advice to a policymaker who was looking to boost manufacturing in the 21st century here in the United States, what would you tell them based on the last couple hundred years of the factory?
Well, you know, I think factories and more factories in the United States are a good idea. It's something I agree with our president about. And I think manufacturing employment would be wonderful to see that go up. But I also know that you know, factories do come and go. And therefore, you know, if you're going to invest money, don't invest, you know, stealing the plant from Louisiana and taking it to Alabama, or, you know, in my view, even to get a company from abroad, but attract factories and industry by making your place attractive with better infrastructure, with better environmental infrastructure, with higher educational standards, with social systems that will help support these workers. Avoid the past where you have a kind of one industry town where you are dependent on the whims of a private factory owner. You may put up $2 billion to get that factory there, but in the end, if that factory owner decides, hey, this isn't working out, we're moving to, you know, Ethiopia, what's going to happen to communities? So, yes, absolutely, work to get manufacturing, subsidize it, but let's do it in a way that speaks to the broader interests of the community and recognizes if we're going to give private factory owners huge subsidies, there should be some social say in how that factory develops.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Joshua Freeman. We've been talking about his new book, Behemoth, A History of the Factory and the Making of the Modern World. This week is the 50th anniversary of 2001, A Space Odyssey. We're going to talk about the influence of the movie and some stories behind the making of it tomorrow here on Central Time. The film is going to return to the big screen later this spring in an unrestored, unremastered 70mm version. And in the news today, I see the Beatles movie, Yellow Submarine, is also going to get a big screen revival in its 50th anniversary year. My question to you, is there a movie that you wish you could see on the big screen? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. I asked Dean Kinnetter that question. Dean, what do you wish you could see on the big screen?
I would love to see Lawrence of Arabia in the movie theater. The first time I saw this film, my jaw was on the floor. I mean, some of these desert landscapes are absolutely beautiful, and YouTube does not do them justice.
You watched it on YouTube, so a computer-sized screen?
I actually got to see it on a pretty nice television,
okay,
and got to see a lot of that detail, but I couldn't imagine what it would look like on the silver screen.
And this was a movie made, as I understand it, for a big screen.
Definitely. 70mm, there's a lot of light, a lot of detail going on in that film, and just incredible locations.
Thanks, Dean. Let us know what movie you wish you could see on the big screen. Yellow Submarine is one of them that's coming your way. This is Central Time.